The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
This episode of the Lawfare podcast is supported by Slanted, how an Asian American troublemaker took on the Supreme Court. Slanted is available wherever books are sold. For a free sample, listeners can go to www.slantedbook.com.
I think there was never going to be much of an appetite for the absolute position that the president's personal lawyers took. I think the real question is, do the justices agree with Dunn that there's so little daylight between his position and the SG's? And if so, is that enough to affirm the decision below, or does that require a vacate and remand if the justices aren't convinced that the district court, that the Second Circuit, that even the state trial court, you know, properly considered the relevant burden?
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, May 12th, 2020. The Supreme Court today held arguments in a blockbuster case. Do the Trump tax returns and associated financial documents at firms like Mazars and Deutsche Bank need to be turned over in response to congressional subpoenas and subpoena by a New York State grand jury? It was a long set of arguments with multiple parties, and we have a discussion that covers it all. Joining me in the virtual jungle studio is Steve Vladek of the University of Texas Law School, Lawfare's managing editor, Quinta Jurassic, and Lawfare's congressional affairs guru, Margaret Taylor. We talked about how this confrontation developed between Congress and the executive. We talked about what the background law is and whether this should be, in fact, a very easy case. And we talked about where the justices seem to be going and how they don't seem to be going in the direction of their prior precedents. It's the Lawfare Podcast, May 12th, the President's Tax Returns and the Supreme Court. Okay, Quinta, get us started. Walk us through what these three cases are that the Supreme Court heard remote oral arguments on today.
Sure. So the first two cases, which were argued together, are Trump v. Mazars and Trump v. Deutsche Bank. The gist is essentially that various congressional committees in the House are looking for various financial records, some of which have to do with Trump and the Trump Organization, from the Mazars accounting firm, which Trump and the organization have used, as well as Deutsche Bank and Capital One. Trump sort of inserted himself between Congress and those entities and said, I don't care if these various financial institutions want to hand over that information to Congress, as indeed they hadn't objected, but I, Trump, am going to put myself in the middle here and try to block Congress from handing this over. And so the question there is really whether Congress is pursuing a legitimate congressional investigation for a legitimate legislative purpose in seeking that information. There's also a question of whether Trump even had standing to insert himself in there, but the justices interestingly kind of didn't even touch that. Then there is the third case, Trump v. Vance, that has a similar setup. Cyrus Vance, who is the Manhattan district attorney, is subpoenaing Mazars as part of a grand jury investigation in New York State. Trump has once again inserted himself in the middle there to try to block this information from being turned over. In this case, the question is a little different because it's framed more as whether or not a state attorney can conduct an investigation that has something to do with the president while the president is still in office. So it's more of a kind of federalism question. In all three cases, there were three parties. So Trump's counsel argued, there was counsel for the House and counsel for the Manhattan District Attorney, respectively. And then the Justice Department also argued as an amicus in all three cases.
Okay, Margaret, before we get into the nitty gritty of these cases, let's talk a little bit about why they matter so much. And it seems to me that there's two significant components of why these cases matter. And they're really quite different from one another. One is that people really care about the president's financial records and his tax returns in particular. And the Supreme Court is now deciding, does the president have to give his tax returns, or does a private party have to give his tax returns and related materials to congressional committees that demanded them and to a state grand jury that demanded them? So do they actually have to be turned over? But the second reason has nothing to do with the documents in question. It has to do with this rather deep question of when and under what circumstances the president can basically frustrate a congressional subpoena to a third party, and by sort of questioning whether the legislative purpose of that subpoena is legit. And so from a congressional oversight point of view, how would you describe the importance of this case?
So I would describe it as groundbreakingly important, revolutionarily important, because, you know, in the past, there has been a fair amount of deference, a lot of deference actually, to congressional subpoenas going to third parties. And that is it's a really important tool that Congress has to conduct its investigations, to do its work. If there are now going to be significant limitations on that power, that has big ramifications for how much Congress can do, how it's going to fulfill its constitutional mandate to engage in its legislative work, to conduct oversight. And just to give you a sense for, you know, in the little bit of the existing case law, you know, in this sphere, I think of the Watkins case from 1957 to be really important, just to give people a sense of how wide the court has really given the Congress a bunch of latitude in this space. So Watkins is a McCarthy era case, and basically this guy, John Watkins, he was a private citizen, a labor organizer. In 1954, he appeared before Joseph McCarthy's House Un-American Activities Committee, and he refused to answer their questions about the communist loyalties of several of his acquaintances. And he was convicted of contempt of Congress. And in that case, the Supreme Court said, there's no general authority to expose the private affairs of individuals without justification in terms of the functions of Congress. No inquiry is an end in itself. Investigations, you know, conducted solely for the personal aggrandizement of the investigators or to punish those investigated are indefensible. This was a case that put limits on Congress, this sort of power, a similar power of Congress, but it shows the limit. Everything else, you know, the Supreme Court has said, like, yes, the Congress can, you know, get that information. This is the, like, limiting story. And it's so specific. It's, you know, does a person have to reveal the communist loyalties of their acquaintances? The answer is no. But that's the limiting principle here. You know, up until now, everything else has basically kind of been fair game. And so if the Supreme Court is now going to significantly alter, you know, that very broad standard, that will really kind of shake things up on Capitol Hill and potentially really limit their ability to get information.
All right. One more question before we get into how the arguments went today. Steve, give us an outline of the basic positions of both sides in this as neutrally as you can.
I'll do my best. So I think the basic positions differ a bit across the two cases. And I think it's really important to differentiate between what the president's personal lawyers have argued and what the Solicitor General argued as a friend of the court on the president's side in both cases. So in the first two cases, in the Mazars and Deutsche Bank cases, you know, the president's personal lawyers really went after the subpoenas on their face and really pushed back against the idea that the Congress could ever issue these kinds of subpoenas for the president's records outside the context of a formal impeachment inquiry, really picking up on the dissenting opinion that had been written in the D.C. Circuit by Trump appointee Judge Naomi Rao. The Solicitor General took a much narrower ambit, focusing on whether Congress had actually demonstrated a, quote, legitimate legislative purpose, unquote, for each of the subpoenas, basically suggesting that the court could rule for the president without fatally undermining Congress's subpoena power if it only put teeth into the legitimate legislative purpose test. And of course, then the question becomes, wasn't there already a legitimate legislative purpose here? That's what the majority held in the D.C. Circuit. And pushing back against that requires going to some degree into whether Congress was acting pretextually, which is something the court, I think, historically is not that in a hurry to try to get into. And then the House's arguments are basically that, you know, they dotted their I's, they crossed their T's, and pursuant to the very broad, you know, well-established deferential standard that Margaret described, these subpoenas were all, you know, well over the bar. They weren't subpoenas to the president himself. There was no assertion of executive privilege. And so as a matter of just facial validity, this should be an easy case, or so the House would have you believe. And then in the Vance case, what's really interesting, to me at least, is that there's more relevant Supreme Court precedent. The justices have already upheld a grand jury criminal subpoena as applied to the president of the United States. That was the Watergate tapes case. The court has already upheld civil litigation against a sitting president based on conduct that predated his tenure in office. That's Clinton versus Jones. And I mean, ironically, those cases were 23 years apart. And here we are 23 years after Clinton versus Jones. And it's just the next question of whether those precedents also apply in state court. The president's personal lawyers have argued that as a categorical matter, the president should be immune from any and all process from state and local prosecutors. Again, the Solicitor General took a meaningfully narrower position, namely that the burden should be on local and state prosecutors to show some kind of special need, which is a burden the D.C. Circuit has articulated in the context of executive privilege assertions. And then the Manhattan DA's position is, you know, we're not doing anything to the president himself. This is a valid criminal investigation into financial misconduct by the president's, you know, organizations and businesses. And if the president has a privilege claim, or if he has any evidence that this is not above board, let him come forward with it. But to attack the subpoena facially without any of those showings would upend all of those precedents. So that's basically the six different positions we heard over a unusually long 3 hours and 15 minutes of arguments this morning.
The Lawfare Podcast is brought to you by the book Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court. Simon Tam, in his book Slanted, offers a firsthand look behind the scenes of one of the most discussed and influential Supreme Court cases of 2017. The memoir recounts the story of one of the few cases that unified people from across the political spectrum, from the Cato Institute to the ACLU. If you enjoy an inside look at major legal battles, this is the book for you. It tackles complex legal issues in approachable everyday language with wit and humor. At the end of the day, it's a memoir about hope, overcoming adversity, and the values that all Americans share, even when those values square off against the government of the United States. The book offers a rare look at the U.S. legal system with unflinching honesty, kind of like this episode of the Lawfare Podcast. You know, we just talk about the oral arguments at the Supreme Court with unflinching honesty, and this is a raw look at the U.S. legal system that has similarly unflinching honesty, and it provides timely insights on freedom of speech, how to connect with others we disagree with, and, of course, the power of music. It's an irrepressible story. It is fresh, present, and it helps define what it means to be an American. So if you're looking for the perfect gift for law students, attorneys, or anyone interested in public policy and rock and roll, here it is. I, for one, am thrilled that this memoir adds to the too small genre of literature, blending the Supreme Court with rock and roll. I very much enjoyed this book, and I learned a lot, and I think Lawfare Podcast listeners will too. The book is Slanted, How an Asian American Troublemaker Took on the Supreme Court, and it's available wherever books are sold. For a free sample, listeners can go to www.slantedbook.com. All right, so that is an overview. Let's now get into how the justices reacted to this and how the arguments went. Quinta, how would you briefly summarize how the arguments went and where you think this leaves us? Are there tea leaves to read here? And what does your gut tell you about where the court is on these two, at one level, similar questions, and at another level, totally different questions?
I'm going to start with Vance here because I think I'll be interested to hear what Margaret and Steve think. But to me, it seemed like it was a little easier to figure out what way things might have been going. So in Vance, the counsel for Vance, Carrie Dunn, was very, very persuasive, I think, not only to me, but to the justices as well, and really seemed to have convinced them that there should not be what Trump's counsel, Jay Sekulow, referred to as absolute temporary immunity from the president to a state-level criminal process. It really seemed like a majority, I don't know how many of the justices were inclined to see things close to Dunn's way, in part because Dunn really was emphasizing how close his position was to that of the Justice Department, that both sort of took the position that, well, we can't completely bar state investigators from looking into these matters. We may want to have some kind of heightened standard. There was a lot of disagreement about what a heightened standard means and who would carry the burden in terms of showing that for allowing state investigators to pursue these probes. But most of the justices seemed inclined to go along with that view. They were just sort of bartering a bit over the specifics of where it would go.
Let me stop you there and see, like, to what extent Margaret and Steve, do you agree with that characterization, or did Sekulow or the Justice Department, the Solicitor General, make more headway in either of your view than they did in Quinta's?
So I guess, you know, I think I basically agree with Quinta's read of the argument, and I certainly agree that Carrie Dunn, I thought, was fantastic. I think there was never going to be much of an appetite for the absolute position that the president's personal lawyers took. I think the real question is, do the justices agree with Dunn that there's so little daylight between his position and the SG's? And if so, is that enough to affirm the decision below? Or does that require a vacate and remand if the justices aren't convinced that the district court, that the Second Circuit, that even the state trial court, you know, properly considered the relevant burden? And I think, you know, that might not be that much of a disagreement on the law, Ben, but it could be a huge disagreement in how the result is portrayed if it's a vacatur versus an affirmance.
Yeah, that's actually a significant point, and it would very much affect the timing, right? Because if they simply affirmed the Second Circuit, you would presumably have, as soon as the mandate issued, immediate compliance with the subpoena, since the recipient of the subpoena doesn't object. On the other hand, if you have a vacature and you have to relitigate the thing at the district court, then all of a sudden we have a long way to go in terms of the timing. All right, so let's then turn, Quinta, to the congressional cases. That argument seems to me to be potentially much more divisive among the justices. How would you characterize how it went?
I agree with that it seemed to be more divisive. The justices did a lot of pushing on counsel for the House of Representatives, Doug Letter, to voice a limiting principle to how much information Congress could conceivably request. And Letter seemed to have difficulty coming up with one. And that produced a lot of sort of hemming and hawing and difficulty among the justices. And I really do think that I will be interested to see where they come out there and how it shakes out. I will say Justice Gorsuch did seem to be interested, asked a couple questions about the court's historical deference toward Congress. And Justice Thomas seemed to be hinting that he wanted to know where the congressional power to issue a subpoena came from in the first place. So it will certainly be interesting to see, whenever the opinion comes out, whether we'll get a concurrence or a dissent from Thomas digging into that question, which Letter also seemed a bit flummoxed by.
All right. So I, Margaret, would instinctively divide the justices into three camps on this. There are three justices, Sotomayor, Ginsburg, and Kagan, who seem to me to show very little or no reservation about the House's position. There were three justices, Breyer, the Chief, and Gorsuch, who were, I would say, equivocal and expressed some reservation that might lead you to think they could go either way. And then there were three justices, with the caveat that Quinta gave, that it's not clear that Justice Thomas believes that there's a legislative subpoena at all, that seemed much more sympathetic to the president's position. Did you read it similarly, or would you describe the camps in some other way?
I did read it similarly, although I might put Kavanaugh in with Gorsuch and Roberts and Breyer, just because my understanding, based on some of his lower court opinions, is his general view is pretty deferential to Congress. He seemed to be exploring this demonstrably critical standard for the scope of the legislative purpose. So he did seem to be sort of engaging with it and sorting through what the limiting principle might be. So to me, he seemed like he was still sort of, you know, asking the question and trying to sort out where he was going to land. But other than that, yeah, I think I would, you know, put the justices in the same types of categories. You know, Alito seemed really sort of baffled by the Doug Letter's inability to explain, you know, how harassment of a president, if there was harassment of a president going on, you know, how would you limit that? So he seemed pretty incredulous to me. You know, are there any limits on a subpoena. So yeah, I'm largely where you are, Ben.
What about you, Steve? How would you divide it up?
So I think that's right as a matter of first impression, but I think Justice Kagan may have been floating a potential compromise that would move her from Ben, the first category you described, into the second, I think in the hopes of attracting, you know, not just the chief, but also Kavanaugh, per Margaret's point. And what Justice Kagan was suggesting was maybe there's a difference among the, I think it's a total of 11 congressional subpoenas at issue in these cases, where the subpoena issued by the House Intelligence Committee seems to be on stronger footing, less of a fishing expedition, more of a direct, justified exercise of legitimate oversight authority. And it's not impossible to imagine a scenario where she and Breyer and the chief all agree to a compromise where they're going to support the HPSI subpoena, they're going to throw out the other subpoenas, and they'll get different majorities for both of those holdings.
And why would you describe, what would be the basis for that factually, that the HPSI subpoena is in some kind of a different status, other than that people have higher regard for HPSI than they do, and for its professionalism, than for a lot of other congressional committees, or at least they used to?
I was going to say, some people. I think, Ben, it might just be that Kagan was thinking that if the court's going to put more teeth into the legitimate legislative purpose test, which, as Margaret notes, has historically been remarkably open-ended and deferential, that might be enough to say, just because you're investigating disclosure requirements for all public officials doesn't mean you can single out the president's tax returns. On the flip side, the House Intelligence Committee investigating, you know, Russian interference and the specter of Russian interference in U.S. elections would be well within its rights to see if a candidate for president had connections to foreign governments, you know, who were properly the subject of such an investigation in the first place. And I think, you know, from Kagan's perspective, if I had to bet, that's an infinitely preferable holding to all of the subpoenas getting struck down. And losing the other subpoenas for a slightly more searching legitimate legislative purpose test would be a small price to pay for the symbolism of a majority opinion that isn't just, you know, Democratic appointees holding that at least one of these subpoenas was legitimate.
What do you think about that, Margaret, as a legislative lawyer hand? Is that a win for Congress if, you know, if the committee that has the best case for it wins, prevails, and gets the chief on it, and maybe even Justice Kavanaugh, but the committees that, you know, that just kind of tossed subpoenas out a little bit more blithely get batted back, is that a win or a loss from your point of view?
I mean, it's only a win in the sense that if the only alternative is that they all get thrown out because the Supreme Court establishes a like new, very high standard on, you know, that's extremely difficult to meet. But in every other respect, I feel like that's a loss because, again, you know, going back to where the baseline is and how all the lower courts decided on all of these cases was to be deferential to the subpoena, find it to be valid, and that was sort of it. And so if what Steve describes really is the outcome, you know, I do think it's a situation where, you know, how this has been set up and discussed has really kind of moved the Overton window in terms of how we think about deference to Congress. And so I think for Congress that it's not a good outcome.
All right. I want to outflank you on this, Margaret.
Go for it, Ben.
Maybe I should say, I want to say that I'm going to say what you're thinking, which is, you know, what the hell? There's a whole lot of precedent here. The precedent does not say Congress can subpoena anything it wants as long as there's a legitimate legislative purpose, unless the president is involved, in which case the president and the courts can examine how legitimate the legislative purpose is. This is being made up out of whole cloth. If an individual like, say, Paula Jones can sue the president and demand discovery over merely stating a claim that survives a motion to dismiss, surely the Congress of the United States, assuming it has subpoena power at all, which I think 8 of the justices at least accept, shouldn't be disadvantaged. And if the mere grand jury in the state of New York can demand these documents from Mazars, surely a congressional committee should be able to, on the same basis that it can demand the same material of anybody else. Why is this even complicated?
Based on the precedents, I really don't think it has to be. And the lower courts didn't find it to be particularly complicated. I mean, I do think that the congressional cases are unprecedented in the sense that I'm not sure this particular factual scenario has ever come up. That said, Ben, I'm kind of with you. And a similar kind of notion came up when the arguments in the D.C. Circuit en banc on the McGahn case were being argued, where one of the judges en banc said something like, well, what if a FOIA request had been submitted? Does an individual submitting a FOIA request have, more rights to information than Congress does? And so I think, some people are kind of getting wrapped around the axle a little bit with the separation of powers. And, I think people are like a little unconfident about, just having a clean, okay, this is our standard, we're just going to go with it. They're very uncomfortable with it. I mean, it came through in the discussion talking about harassment of the president. And it was interesting to hear that discussion because we're familiar with this notion of there being a burden, if there's an undue burden on someone like the president or anyone to produce information. And we think of that as like, well, is it like taking away from the president's duties or whatever? But in the argument, it was different. It was like harassment of the president, because the president doesn't have to do anything here. It's just a private, entity producing some documents. The president has to do nothing. But they really explore this idea of harassment. Like, what if the House of Representatives is going to harass the president? So I think that's where their like discomfort is coming from, is like, how will this, if they continue to grant the House of Representatives like an unencumbered subpoena power, how will it be used to sort of abuse the president? And what consequences will that have for the separation of powers?
Yeah, so I want to say a word in defense of presidential harassment. My entire adult life, the House of Representatives has been harassing the president whenever they are not of the same party. And I thought that was part, and the Senate, by the way, and I thought that was part of what the House and the Senate were for. And this sudden tender solicitude for that the president should be free of harassment, that came as news to me. Steve, what do you think? Is this actually, like, leaving aside how the justices reacted to this, is this just an easy case that certain justices are developing anxieties about where all their cases lead and creating a sort of separation of powers anxiety out of what is, at least in case law, nothing?
Yes. There's a, the Strict Scrutiny podcast has swag with the caption, "Stare Decisis is for suckers." And I think that's, part of my reaction to this conversation, which is, I agree with all of this. I mean, I think the precedent is clearly on Congress's side. I think the implications of striking down any of these subpoenas are pretty alarming for the future of congressional oversight. And I think there are 5 justices who may just not care, and who have views about the office of the president and the peculiar function of the, person who serves as the chief executive, that are hard to square with a lot of that case law. I think the lawyer for President Trump in the congressional cases at various points came pretty close to saying that Clinton versus Jones is wrongly decided, that some of the Watergate era cases are wrongly decided. And I think he's tapping into a vein that at least, you know, some of the justices share, which is that, you know, congressional harassment may be good politics, Ben, and you and I may even think it's good accountability and good separation of powers, but it's bad con law. I don't agree with that. I think this really ought to have been an easy case. You know, until Judge Rao's dissent, there hadn't been a single federal judge to ever adopt anything close to the positions being advanced either by the president or by the Justice Department here. But I think, you know, my read of the argument is that there are now at least four justices, perhaps even five. And, you know, that's why I think by the end of the argument, you heard Justice Kagan and to a lesser degree, maybe even Justice Breyer, you know, trying to sort of think through what some kind of compromise result might be versus, you know, what should have seemed like an obvious answer when this case got to the Supreme Court in the first instance.
Can I just add on to that point? I agree with everything that has been said. What it was really striking to me that in a way it seemed that Letter was having difficulty identifying the limiting principle the justices seemed to want precisely because the court's previous rulings on this matter have given so much deference to Congress. And it's sort of interesting in light of that the justices were really, really pressing him. And based on, you know, the jurisprudence on his side, you could imagine coming out there swinging and saying, like, hell yeah, we're Congress. We're a coordinate branch of government. We can, you know, look at McGrain, right? We can investigate whatever we want. We're not going to, you know, dig into the possible Communist Party registration of someone's friends 50 years ago, but we have a really broad swath here. And instead, he was put on the defensive. So I think I hate the term Overton window, but I do think that the Rao ruling and just the sheer chutzpah, which with Trump and the Justice Department sort of really came out swinging in this case, really succeeded in kind of dragging the window of what's available for Congress to do from a very expansive view of congressional authority toward one that is, you know, we're now discussing just how much ground Congress is going to lose. And I think that that's just, it's pretty astonishing.
But maybe Doug Letter screwed up there. Maybe when he was asked for a limiting principle, maybe he should have said, there is no limiting principle, just as there's no limiting principle about what crimes the Justice Department can investigate. The answer is discretion, and the check is political. And the answer, Mr. Justice or Madam Justice, to I forget which justice asked this question.
They all did.
Could you go after the president's medical records? Is sure. If you're a congressional committee and you have the guts to issue a subpoena for the president's cardiac records, there's nothing in principle invalid about that. You just have to be able to take the political heat for an outrageous abuse of your lawful discretion.
Ben, I mean, I think that would have helped. I mean, I think, you know, Doug, I think, didn't do himself any number of favors this morning, but I think he probably didn't think he could say that. Right. I mean, to Quinta's point, like, I think the argument came across to me as Doug knowing that the precedents support a pretty, at least legally, limitless subpoena power where the political checks are the relevant checks. And he just, you know, had to believe that that wasn't going to fly. And he tried at one point. I mean, I think toward the end of the argument on the medical records point, he even suggested there could be a context where in like a 25th Amendment context, where those records actually would be relevant to a congressional inquiry and investigation. So I think he was stuck between a rock and a hard place, the rock being the unwillingness to agree to characterizing any of the case law as recognizing any of the limits that Trump and the Justice Department were arguing for, and the hard place being, you know, five justices who just don't care about that case law, or at least aren't going to be bound by that case law in a way that for example, all of the lower courts have been throughout this litigation.
All right. I want to turn to the one thing that may discipline some of the justices in practice, and that is what we'll actually write. So now imagine that you're Justice Kavanaugh or the chief, right? And you're trying to write that the narrowest possible opinion, the least sweeping opinion that will actually A, command five votes, and B, get rid of some of these or all of these subpoenas. And you've got to deal not merely with Watkins, but also with the fact that you're going to, the same day, uphold Cyrus Vance getting these same documents, assuming you are. And number three, you also have to assimilate Paula Jones. So you've got to write an opinion that says Paula Jones can get this material if it's relevant in her litigation. And we're sure the district judge can handle whatever burdens on the presidency this might create. She can even depose the president about his tax returns. Cyrus Vance can get this material. The mere state of New York, can the city of New York district attorney, can get this material. The Congress of the United States, notwithstanding the 9-0 opinion in Paula Jones and the 9-0 opinion in U.S. v. Nixon, cannot get this material with a subpoena because we question its legislative purpose. How do you write that opinion? I just don't see how that opinion writes.
I mean, I don't think the roadblocks here are Nixon and Clinton versus Jones, and I'm not even sure the roadblocks are McGrain and Kilbourn. I think the roadblocks are like the travel ban case, because the way you write that opinion is you make it all about what Congress was really up to, as opposed to what Congress said it was up to.
Right. So we're not allowed to look behind the president's pretext in the travel ban case, but we're sure going to look behind Congress's pretext in issuing this subpoena.
Can I also point out briefly, I mean, there was an astonishing moment about this in argument where Justice Thomas was discussing the what information the committees were seeking, and letter answered, and Thomas cut in, "We all know this is about the president," which I think that's sort of like, there it is right there, right? That's the question of whether you can look behind. All right, back to Steve.
That was Ginny Thomas who said that.
but this is the problem, is that, like, I think, you know, this is a court that is not shy about those kinds of inconsistencies, because they can come up with some kind of factually satisfying distinction, even if it doesn't hold up to even relatively modest analytical scrutiny. And so I think what makes that opinion hard to write, Ben, isn't any of the prior congressional subpoena cases, it's the travel ban. And I think the court will just say, you know, there are reasons why Congress is not entitled to the same respect in this context that the president is. And they'll point to Article 2, and they'll point to one president versus 535 members of Congress. And, you know, they'll go about their business. Of course, I think that will resonate a lot differently if part of the opinion is nevertheless upholding the Hipsey subpoena, because I think, you know, folks will look and say, all right, the court, you know, they reached a compromise. They found a middle ground in a dispute without an obvious one, even though, as I think Margaret and Quinta have both alluded to, that would have real damage for the separation of powers going forward. It would, I think, spare the court the embarrassment of an opinion that says none of these subpoenas were valid.
Not to mention the embarrassment of a 5-4 liberal conservative or conservative liberal split on a matter that benefits the president.
Right. Compared to both, you know, Nixon, which was 8-0, and Clinton versus Jones, which was 9-0.
Right. Margaret, what's your bottom line? You got to the end of these arguments, and are you looking forward to the opinion, or are you dreading it?
So I guess what I would say is I'm looking forward to it in the sense that, you know, this has been going on for over a year now. You know, Trump sued Mazars in April of 2019. You know, getting some kind of answer on this will be, in some sense, I think, satisfying. But I'm dreading it in the sense that I'm just very concerned along the lines that Steve has outlined, that it's not going to preserve for Congress the right amount of deference. And I do wonder, maybe this is a question for Steve, is there a world in which, you know, somehow the justices rule, but then the case kind of goes back down to lower courts for more consideration or something like that? And so, you know, is there a circumstance under which this kind of just drags out more and more and more, and then we're at November and it's the election, and it's, if Trump loses, then it's moot?
So I guess I see that as a possibility in the Vance case, because I think it's quite possible that the Supreme Court could say, we are today articulating a slightly different standard than the one that was followed here, so you should go back and apply the new standard. I don't know how you do that in Mazars. Maybe you do it in the Deutsche Bank case, because as Judge Livingston, I think, pointed out in her panel dissent in the Second Circuit, there was already some maneuvering at the margins. I think the Second Circuit panel decision already required a remand. So, but the problem in the Mazars case is that the case was litigated so directly on the question of whether Congress had a legitimate legislative purpose. You know, if the court puts new teeth into that standard, I don't know how that's a vacatur as opposed to just a reversal. You know, I don't know why the court would say, we're creating a new standard, but we're not going to apply it. And we're going to leave it to the lower courts to apply it in the first place. I think everyone would see through that. So I think it's, you know, quite possible we get to June or July and we get a decision in these cases. And maybe, you know, Trump loses Vance, which I think is actually a distinct possibility. And he wins all or at least some of the congressional cases. And, you know, the election comes and no one other than the grand jury in Manhattan has actually seen these financial records. I think that's a deeply distinct possibility.
I also think there's one other possibility that we should take account of, which is that the court, leave aside Vance for a moment, that the court strikes down all of the subpoenas, articulating a set of deficiencies in Congress's performance of its functions, i.e., there was no specific legislation under consideration. The subpoena was not tied to any specific legislative ideas, right? And then Congress relatively quickly or even immediately uses that opinion as a roadmap to reissue the subpoenas. And so it's not further litigation that happens. It's that Congress loses in a fashion that seems like it actually provides a roadmap for Congress to behave in a fashion that would then be much more bulletproof in future litigations. Also doesn't produce a resolution by the time of the election, but I think is subtly quite different from the version in which there's a remand for further litigation.
Yeah, and Ben, your comment reminds me of something we haven't really touched on, but the justices discussed with the people who are making the arguments, which is that there were some questions around the process by which the House committees issued the subpoena, at least one of them. And so a number of the justices sort of explored that. So I do wonder if that's part of some of these justices' consideration. In particular, they were saying, well, you know, the House, first the subpoena was issued, and then only later did the House sort of do this ratifying vote. In reality, the chairs of these committees already had subpoena power. It was that later vote was done sort of as a ratification or pro forma, in my view. But they did sort of ask some of those procedural questions. And that's a slightly different question of, you know, how deferential is the court to Congress in terms of its own processes that it creates and follows?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a, you could imagine that being a sort of Pyrrhic victory for the president, where on the day the opinion comes down, it looks like the justices, you know, strike down all these subpoenas, but the deficiencies they identify are really easy to correct. And then Congress has an on-point Supreme Court opinion that says, here's what you need to do, here's how you harass a president. And so for all future presidential harassments, notice a hearing first, have a bill introduced. You know, this is the bill to require all presidential candidates to disclose their tax returns. You hold a hearing on this bill, and then you have a witness who says, maybe Steve Vladek. And Steve Vladek says, you know, it would be really helpful to actually have some presidential tax returns to give flavor to this conversation. And then the chairman would have to say, Professor Vladek, that's so interesting. What an interesting idea. Do you think we have the authority to subpoena that? And Professor Vladek would say, why, yes, Mr. Chairman, there's an on-point statute that gives you that authority. Then the Supreme Court would say, because you didn't jump through any of those hoops, this subpoena is invalid. But the result is that you have a very clear delineated set of things that you have to do in order to issue that subpoena.
Can I just say—
Okay. Quinta, I was going to say, wrap us up.
I was just going to comment that, Ben, you may have been getting at this, but what you described there reminds me, ironically, a lot of what Roberts did in the census case and in the travel ban case, of kind of saying, okay, you may have wanted to, you know, issue an executive order for a particular end, but because you created an administrative record, that's okay. Or in the case of the census, all right, you wanted to make this change in the census. You didn't create an administrative record. The problem is the record, right? Like you end up in a, if you're trying to evaluate good faith, you end up in a similar posture of saying, you know, here are all the boxes you have to tick, even though we all know that you wanted to do this anyway.
Right. So Steve, final thoughts. Are you, how plausible do you think that outcome is, and how much are you dreading the decision day in this opinion?
I think it's deeply plausible. I am terribly fearful of what the Supreme Court's going to do. I still think Vance is going to come out what to me is the right way. I actually think, you know, the justices just weren't nearly as aggressively disinclined to agree with Vance as they were with Congress. But I think part of the conversation that I really think ought not to be neglected is whatever the Supreme Court decides, you know, there are two other things that we ought to be not losing sight of. One is the en banc DC Circuit decision in the McGahn case, which it increasingly looks like, you know, may not be sort of beholden to this ruling. But second, you know, when the new Congress comes in January, one of the things it really ought to think about is actually passing a statute to clarify so many of these issues, cementing individual committee subpoena powers by statute, creating a judicial review procedure so that these cases won't take 3-4 years, so that you won't have the opportunity to moot them out simply by waiting for an election, providing a fast track procedure for the assertion of privilege claims. Like, there's just no reason for Congress to leave so much of this for the courts to decide in the first instance. You know, one of the procedural reforms I very much hope Congress contemplates, not just in reaction to the Trump presidency, but really to almost all recent presidencies, is putting a lot more teeth into its subpoena enforcement and a lot more, you know, clear contemplation of a judicial role. And I think that would go a long way as well.
We are going to leave it there, although I suspect we will have occasion to reconvene to discuss an opinion relatively soon. Steve Vladek, Margaret Taylor, Quinta Jurecek, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You know, it's days like this that you appreciate Goat Rodeo and the folks who make the Lawfare Podcast sound good from multiple locations. It's also days like this that you appreciate our editor, Jen Patya Howell, who's putting all this together and, you know, making it sound like we were all sitting in the same room. And it's days like this when you should be appreciating the Lawfare Podcast and saying, I think I'll go leave a rating and review at whatever podcast distribution service I found the Lawfare podcast on, because gosh, those people are working hard and they deserve 5 stars. And maybe they should even get a written review. It's days like this when you think, huh, maybe I should be like that baby in Benjamin Wittes's Good Morning tweet this morning and buy some Lawfare swag. If you want to do that, you can go to thelawfarestore.com. And on this day, as on all days, you should thank Sophia Yan, who plays our music. And as always, thanks for listening.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.